in. That must be a sign. Thanks for coming, everyone. My name is Tom Hollander. I'm an architect in Microsoft's developer experience and evangelism team based out of Sydney. Thanks very much for coming to hear my talk today. I'm going to talk about migrating an identity-centric app to Azure. So basically, this is a case study of an application that I've built with some colleagues in Microsoft that was an intranet application. And basically, we're going to be talking about some of the challenges and some of the solutions that we ran into when we decided to move this application to Azure. So it's about a specific application, which is hopefully kind of somewhat interesting, because it's got a bunch of different components and different technologies to consider. But hopefully, some of the things that you're seeing in this application will be pretty similar to some of the things that you might have in some of your own internet applications. So the real thing I want you to take away from this is sort of a bunch of techniques, understanding of certain technologies that might help you move some of your own internal applications that have lots of hooks into Active Directory and help move those to Azure. The real takeaway is that migrating an existing application to Azure is really easy, except for the hard bits. And that's kind of true with everything. And the hard bits will be different for different applications. There's usually only a pretty small number of hard things, but sometimes they can be quite hard. Identity is always a pretty complex beast, but the good news is there's a whole bunch of very interesting technologies and techniques available in Azure that can really make it very easy for you to, that can really give you a fantastic result once you move these applications to the cloud. So the overall plan for today, so meet the patient. I'm going to introduce you the application that we've migrated to the cloud, and it's called Find Me. So I'm going to give you a quick demo and really just point out where the interesting identity-centric features are, where we're hooking into Active Directory and other things, just so you can kind of understand what that means for your application. I'll talk a little bit about the decision to move it to Azure, why we did that, and some of the interesting constraints that we had for this particular application. And then I'm going to dive into three particular identity topics. So I'm going to talk a bit about authentication and authorization, which are things that absolutely every interesting application has to deal with. And I'm also going to talk about directory queries, which is possibly not something that you do in every application, but possibly something that you maybe should think about doing a little bit more, because some of the things you can do when you actually query a directory to make it a little bit more socially aware help you build some more interesting and useful applications. So let's start with meeting the patient. And the application we're talking about is something called Find Me. And just to give you a little bit of context about why we built this, and this is actually a spare time project that I built with a couple of colleagues. But the Microsoft Sydney office, quite a big office, there's I think about 600 people in there. And it used to be kind of cubicle land, so if you've seen Dilbert, that kind of typical thing, not particularly inspiring. And about 3 years ago, they went and basically ripped out all the cubicles, ripped out all of the furniture, and completely transformed it to what's called an activity-based working environment. Anyone else got activity-based working where you are? It's a growing trend in a lot of organizations, and basically it means no fixed desks, and a variety of different spaces that people can use depending on how they're working. So the cynical people say it's just glorified hot desking, but when it's done well, you'll have nice lounge areas, you'll have standing areas, you'll have some traditional desks, you'll have meeting rooms, you'll have phone rooms. And the idea is that throughout the day, depending on what you're doing and who you're meeting with, you actually go and work in a different part of the building. And overall, people thought it was bloody fantastic, much, much more pleasant environment than it was before. But I have one really interesting challenge in that in the old days when someone had that little cubicle, which was often wasted space when they were out half the time, but if you needed to find someone, you went to their cubicle and that's where they were. With activity-based working, you don't know where someone's going to be because they're in a different spot every day and a different spot in different times of the day. So we set out to come up with a solution that would make it really easy to find people no matter where they were. And we did that with, and I'll show you a quick demo, but we used a Wi-Fi-based geolocation as well as docking station geolocation so we can actually draw them on a map. And then we extended to other kinds of office scenarios, including looking at meeting room availability, booking meeting rooms, and there's a few other scenarios we're looking at as well. So it's been way more successful than we thought. Like, it was something we literally sort of did over a quiet week and deployed it in one office. And now I think we're deployed in about 30 offices around Microsoft. And while it's not the point of this presentation, I know I'll be asked. So if you like what this is and think it might be interesting for you, drop me a mail, because there's people who we can talk to about making this available for you as well. So before I do a demo, this is kind of the 100,000 foot view, really, of the architecture. So it's obviously more complex than this, but I just sort of wanted to show you the different components, because when we start talking about the architecture and they're looking at the demo, you want to sort of understand what's what. So pretty predictable kind of architecture. It does show that we have a few different client experiences. So I'll start in the middle. The tray application is something which basically runs on everyone's machine and senses the environment. Including what are the Wi-Fi signals you can see, what are the docking stations you're plugged into, what does your internal location API say about you, and it gathers all that information and sends it back to the service. The service knows about which Wi-Fi hotspots are in which buildings and which docking stations are in which buildings, and basically is a web service, a REST service that's got a SQL database that stores information both about the fixed things like the Wi-Fi docking, Wi-Fi hotspots, as well as the last known location of all the people. So that's what the service is. The website is basically the primary user experience that people use to interact with FindMe. So how to find people, how to book meeting rooms is all through the website. We also have something called the kiosk, and that's a Windows 8 application that we have in basically lobbies of buildings. If you've ever been to the Auckland or Wellington office, you might have seen those, a touchscreen application, which I'll also show you. But that's basically a kind of a public interface, not designed for individual users' PCs, but you're running late for a meeting, you haven't booked a room, which rooms are free, quickly book one, etc. The website and the kiosk application all talk to those same back-end REST services to get information from the database. So if I just switch over just to quickly look, and I'll point out the interesting identity features of the application as well. So I'll start off with the website, because that's kind of the most interesting kind of thing. So when you come into the site, I'm trying to find someone. So you can see that I've got a few favorite people, and it can show me where they are already. But if I'm typing someone's name, so let me type. So a couple of things here. So not groundbreaking, you've seen this before, but just from an identity perspective, you can see that I've typed in part of somebody's name, and it's come up with some autocomplete suggestions. And these are people in the corporate Active Directory. So I can see I've got a couple of different people. I'm interested in that person. And what the application does is comes up and shows where Matt is sitting and which building he's in. So he's currently in Wellington. And you can see where he is in the room. You can also see these meeting rooms. I can go and hover over them and see they're all free at the moment. You can also see his link presence as well, so that's very interesting as a user. So I can see that he's there, but he's also yellow, so he's actually quite possibly, that's where his computer is, but he might have gone down for coffee, so that might influence whether I could be bothered going and talk to him or not. So you can see here also we know exactly what desk he's on, because that's because he's wired into a docking station. So if I type in someone else, people move around, so sometimes I type someone, there we go. So we found someone else. So she's in the Auckland office. You can see that rather than being a push pin, she's actually got a halo around her. So that's because she's not plugged into a docking station, she's on Wi-Fi. So her location is a little bit more approximate, but if she's able to, if she walked or moved to a different part of the building without doing anything, then the updated Wi-Fi signals would sort of show roughly where you are. And by the way, before anyone gets really super paranoid about piracy, no one's forced to install it, people run it because they like it, and it helps people find each other. So you can also see, a couple of things, you also see we've got photos. So the photos also come from our Active Directory, so no one needs to manually upload those photos. Also gives a really nice experience for end users, so integrating photos makes applications more personal, is actually more practical. If I've never met Deborah, I'm trying to find her, it's actually really nice to know what she looks like. These meeting rooms as well, you can see here that this one's green and it's free until 10 a.m. This one is red, and there's this particular meeting, and it's busy until 10 a.m. So all that information comes out of Exchange calendars as well. So, and being able to integrate with Exchange and other kind of other systems in your network also have identity implications around those as well. So that's the website. The Tray app is not really demoable because the whole point about the tray app is you install it and forget about it. So this little crosshair thing basically means the tray app's running. It's got a couple of configuration dialogues and stuff like that that are not overly interesting. But that's the thing that basically sits in the background and gathers that information and sends it back to the Find Me service. And finally, we have this kiosk application. So this is the thing that's installed on touchscreens in lobbies. So same basic stuff you do on the website, but it's all a Windows 8 application, so I can... it's a little bit sluggish sometimes, but I can swipe, I can see different buildings. It's very early in the morning, so lots of free meeting rooms in Sydney. It will not be like that later in the day. Not many people in, but I can go and find people as well. And if I wanted to book a room, I could go and click a room if it catches up with me. I could click a room and basically do an ad hoc booking as well. So that's what the kiosk is. Also talking to those same REST services, and that will wake up in a minute. So anyway, let's go back. And re-look at this architecture diagram, and I'm going to add a few more things just to talk about what it means from an identity perspective. So the key sort of systems that we need to interact with to make this work, we have Link, which shows that user's presence in the halos. We have Active Directory, which is both used for authenticating and the user, but as well as doing those back-end queries that that help us do things like the autocomplete and the photos and stuff like that. And we also have Exchange Server, which is where we get all that meeting room information from. So identity is often really straightforward on internet applications because everyone is in this trust boundary called a domain. So your servers are in the domain, your clients are in the domain, the user logged in with their username and password. Those credentials can flow from one thing to another thing. So when you are signed in with your onto your PC with domain credentials, you can specify this wonderful thing called Windows Authentication on all your websites. So basically that means that we know who the user is, they're logged in, that's going to flow. There's things like Kerberos and stuff happening in the background, but as a developer you really don't know or care about what that stuff is. You can just tick that thing, say, yes, this is, I want to know who the user is, and everything works. So very, very, very simple. Talking to Active Directory, there is this thing called LDAP, which has been around for a long time, which is basically a syntax for querying Active Directory to say, find me all the users whose name starts with Matt, or find me the organization chart of this particular person, or get me the attribute, which might be a photo or their full name or something like that. So an API has been around forever. It's full of memory leaks. So if you ever implement it, you probably have a bunch of fun challenges, but you can get a lot of information out of that. Exchange Server is, so all that information about the meeting rooms is in a mailbox. You can't just walk in off the street and talk to a corporate Exchange Server. You need to have a mailbox and credentials. The way we did this is we actually weren't using the end user's credentials. We were just using the domain account that the IIS application pool was running under. Because for what we were doing, we didn't really care about who the end user is. We just need rights to be able to query Exchange calendars. So if we had different requirements, we could have use the user's credentials, but that would have been probably Kerberos double hop type of issues, which is where identity does get challenging on on-premises situations. But and finally, that Link integration, it looks really cool, but it is really cool. It's actually all done with a browser plugin. So it works on multiple browsers now. It's not just IE, it also works on Chrome and Firefox and Safari, I think, for that matter as well. But basically, the web page is interacting via the Link application, which is running on the PC to get the presence for other users. So that's actually quite a nice trick. SharePoint does it. There's not a lot of documentation on how to do it, but I did write some blog posts a couple of years ago when I built this. So to search for, Link name control, and you'll see some blogs if you're interested in doing that. Okay, so that's how the application was architected when it was on-premises. Let's talk a little bit about Azure. So why put this thing on Azure? Well, one interesting question you might ask, well, you're a Microsoft guy, why didn't you build it on Azure in the first place? Which is a pretty decent question, because almost always it's actually easier and quicker to build things on Azure in the first place. You don't need to find servers, you don't need to do a whole bunch of things. The key reason is we really didn't think this thing was going to go anywhere. And we knew from the start that some of these identity things were actually going to be quite challenging. So for what was sort of a throwaway thing, it actually, for us, was the path of least resistance to just rely on that Windows authentication crutch and just get something working. And we actually did deploy to quite a few Microsoft buildings, literally on a server under someone's desk, which is the way a lot of these things start. But there was a few challenges. Firstly, by being entirely on-premises, restricted to the domain, you're really limiting your reach. So you can't build mobile experiences, you can't build experiences for machines that aren't on the domain, you can't make it easily work if you're externally, unless you want to use VPNs or direct access or something like that. So you're really limiting your reach, even if it is designed for your employees. Most organizations have very mobile kind of workforces, so being on the internet is often very restrictive. From a DevOps perspective, the first point's probably pretty well understood. It sucks maintaining and building and acquiring hardware. You've got to patch it, you've got to kick it every now and then. When things don't work, it's basically your problem. And you have very limited options for scaling or also setting up additional environments. So if you want to have a test environment or a beta environment as well as production, it either means you have to go and put lots of things on one machine, which is not a really great separation strategy, or you have to go and find more physical boxes or virtual boxes, which is also a pain. So a great thing about the cloud is spin up new environments on demand, scale on demand. If we suddenly get 10 times as many people using it, use 10 times as many VMs, really cheap and easy to do that. I also mentioned that while this is something we built for Microsoft, we've had a bunch of interest from people externally who say, can we have this? And by being able to offer it in the cloud to say, look, yes, you can have this, and by the way, you don't need any servers, actually makes it really attractive for external customers that want this. And while we're not doing it now, it also opens the possibility of even turning this into like a software as a service application if we're ever so inclined. So you need to do a bit of work to make it multi-tenant, but being in the cloud is really a prerequisite for these sort of as a service kind of offerings. So because of this kind of dual nature of the application, it's something that we use internally as Microsoft employees, but it's also something that we're selling to customers. They had added a couple of extra constraints when we're looking at moving it to Azure. So because it's not just about Azure, it's about what are you interacting with. And Microsoft's got a reasonably complex environment, as you probably imagine. So we have Azure Active Directory federated with Active Directory Federation services. Is kind of the way that our cloud apps need to be authenticated, which is probably more complex than most customers have. We've also got a zillion Exchange servers. Some of them are Office 365, some of them are on-prem, so figuring out how to integrate with Exchange is kind of interesting. When we're looking at, we make this available to customers, our focus is on a pure Azure environment where we use Azure Active Directory to authenticate users that may or may not be dir-synced back to their on-prem AD, putting everything on Azure and integrating with their Exchange environment. But some customers, unfortunately, also say, well, great, we want that, but we're not allowed to use the cloud or we're not ready for it. So it was also a design constraint for us that while we wanted to make the whole application perfect for the cloud, we actually didn't want to have different code. We needed a single code base that could also be deployed on-premises. So we really wanted to limit the cloud-specific things to configuration rather than actually rewrite half of the application. And we actually accomplished that really well. So I'll show you how we did that. But first, let me just show you the main things we used when we deployed this thing to Azure, sort of the basics. So this is the Windows Azure portal, the Microsoft Azure portal, which hopefully you've all seen. This application, most of it is ported really, in a really straightforward way. So we chose to use a cloud service. So you can see I've got FireMeMS is actually our production slot. You can see we've got an alpha and a beta. And we also have something called Ocelot. Ocelot is our kind of pretend customer tenant that we use for testing. So we can spin up really as many environments as we want really, really easily. So that's where all the compute stuff is. We almost certainly could run it in an Azure website instead of an Azure cloud service. At the time we made this decision, there were a few more restrictions on Azure websites. There's very few things you can't do. If it's a web application, you can almost always use websites, and it's quicker and easier than cloud services. So if you haven't checked those out, I'd definitely suggest doing that. From a database perspective, we're just using the Azure SQL database. So we've got a few random things, but FireMe is our production database. FireMe Ocelot is for our test tenant there. The thing I really wanted to show you, which you may not have seen, is Azure Active Directory. So Azure Active Directory is not on-premises Active Directory just running in the cloud. It's a brand new service. And in most sort of corporate environments, you'll actually have both an on-prem Active Directory and an Azure Active Directory, and they'll be synchronized. So you can set up something called DirSync, which basically means that all of your accounts are replicated from one to the other, and you can choose whether or not you want to copy the passwords. So within when you go to Azure Active Directory, you can see I've got my whole Microsoft AD, which I can look at but not touch. Well, I can't modify users or anything. But you can actually go and create a brand new Active Directory tenant in about 1 minute if you feel like it. It won't be synced to anything, but if you look at my Ocelot one, for example, you can just go in the portal. You can also do all this with PowerShell if you feel like, but I can go and create users. So these are all pretend users, but really simple experience. I can go and create users. I can set their passwords. I can go and add them to groups, so standard kind of group membership stuff. So if you want to go and sort of build a directory, really, really straightforward to do that. And by the way, Azure Active Directory is also what's used to authenticate Office 365 users. So if you've got Office 365, you've got Azure Active Directory, whether you're aware of that or not. When you're an application developer, though, as well as just having a directory with users in it, you need to be able to create things called applications. And when you create applications, there's basically things you create that give you GUIDs is really all there are. There's a couple of things you can do. But if I look at it, see, I've got different applications for the Find Me Services and the Find Me Tray app. But basically, they live in the directory. You can specify a few things like your silent URLs and a bit of branding. But basically, it will give you some... It'll give you things like client IDs that you have to insert into your configuration in a couple of places. So very, very quick to do. You know, I can create a new application in not much time at all. There are a few more advanced things about delegating permissions, but yeah, go and have a play and sort of get familiar with AAD. It's a very interesting technology. You can go and set up your own test tenants, and then if you haven't got your internal Active Directory exposed to AAD, go talk to your friendly IT people and make them do it, because it opens up a whole range of really interesting scenarios. So as I mentioned at the start, moving an application to Azure is almost all easy. And in the case of Find Me, taking an application which wasn't designed explicitly for the cloud, it was just an IIS web app and a few other things, but it just worked when we put it into the cloud service. So we chose to put the website and the Find Me service, which are actually two separate projects, actually co-host them in the same web role. So the website's the root, the Find Me service was basically an IIS application. And that was the same configuration we had on premises, so that was really easy. Business logic, literally no changes. Everything we wrote just worked, and that's what you'd expect. It was a .NET application. Everything was just the same, really, in terms of how it all runs. The Exchange integration really was almost no changes. The only things that we needed to do, I mentioned before that when we're talking to Exchange on premises, it was actually connecting to Exchange Web Services using the credentials of the IIS application pool, which was a domain user. When you are in Azure, nothing is a domain user unless you do all sorts of go through a bunch of pain to actually set up domain controllers or VPNs or something like this. So normally everyone's just a local user. What we had to do is basically specify the username and password when we connected to AWS of a domain account. So it didn't actually matter that we weren't running under a domain account as long as we had those credentials available. The only other slight thing, which wasn't really to do with Azure, but at the time we did this, a bunch of on-prem Exchange servers moved to Office 365 Exchange Online. And in order to connect to Exchange Online, you need to make sure that you connect as username@domain.com rather than domain/username. But everything else was just exactly the same for Exchange. And for Link, there was literally no changes at all because we didn't talk directly to Link, we just interacted with the Link name control via an ActiveX/browser plugin. So the fact that you're no longer on the domain or no longer in physically in the building didn't actually make any difference for the Link connectivity at all. So the hard bit, which is not at all surprising given the name of the presentation, is around identity. So then the biggest single thing is that wonderful crutch called Windows Integrated Authentication does not work. Your clients may or may not be in the domain. Your server components are definitely not in the domain. So Windows Integrated Authentication does not work. There is an Active Directory, but you can't talk to it directly because it's sitting comfortably within the firewalls and the code is all running in the cloud and can't talk directly to that Active Directory. So there is something called a Zero Active Directory, which I mentioned before, but you can't talk to it over LDAP. So the way of getting that directory information needed to change. The other interesting thing about this application is we actually had such an interesting mix of technologies. So we had a website, we had a web API, we had a WinForms application, which is a tray app, and we have a Windows 8 modern application, which is the kiosk. And while there are some common architectural themes in how we built it, it certainly wasn't one size fits all. And we really had to get a whole bunch of things, particularly around the API working, before the application was usable. Well, if anyone's got any questions, let me know. Really good questions might also get some stuff. So I know we're all big stuff fans around here. So authentication. So yeah, there's internal apps basically always need authentication. Public apps sometimes don't. But if it's something's an internal application, you always need authentication. If nothing else, just to make sure the people who are accessing it are indeed internal people. So the approach to, and both the requirements and the approach to authentication were actually a bit different for each of these components, for the website, for the tray app, and for the kiosk application. So for the website, the requirements are as follows. So firstly, we need to know who the user is. So the homepage of Find Me was personalised to me. It told me where I am. It told me where my friends, my colleagues are. So the only way you can do any of that stuff is to actually know who the end user is. Everyone hates being prompted for credentials. It's kind of a reality when you're looking at putting more things on the cloud that you can't completely ignore them. The promise of true single sign-on just isn't there. And particularly if you might not even be accessing it from a work PC, so you're accessing from a home PC or a phone. There are times when you need to be prompted for credentials, but we wanted to make sure that you weren't prompted more often than was strictly necessary. We needed the same solution to work for both Microsoft and customer deployments, and again, not architecturally change the application so much it wouldn't work on premises. And one of the interesting requirements around the website is it's a sort of a typical modern, not quite a single page application, but almost all of the interesting logic is in JavaScript talking to the REST API. So when we're looking at authentication for the website, it wasn't just about making sure that the HTML pages knew who you were. We needed to make sure that the browser could actually make requests to the server, make REST JSON calls, and that those were authenticated as well. And the techniques for those two things are often kind of not the same. So on-premises, as in, no work at all, just everything was Windows integrated authentication, no code, no configuration, no anything. The solution for Azure was using a protocol called WS Federation. Even if you don't know what WS Federation is, you've used it. For passive WS Federation, that's basically the model where you go to a web page. The web page says, I don't know who you are. It redirects you to an external identity provider, which says, who are you? You enter your credentials. The external identity provider will authenticate you. It will issue a token of some kind and post that back to the original website. The website will go and say, yeah, that token comes from an identity provider I trust. Therefore, I know who this user is. And then it will set up a session, usually using cookies. So WS Federation's an industry standard protocol. It's used by all sorts of things. Azure Active Directory and Active Directory Federation services both support WS Federation. And if you're programming on ASP.NET, there's something called Windows Identity Foundation, which basically handles all of that hard work around understanding tokens and generating principles and determining if you have a session and redirecting when you don't. So it sounds complicated, but it's actually not a whole lot that you need to do to set that up. So passive federation works great for web pages. It doesn't work well for APIs. Because you can't call an API and then have it redirect to a HTML page. It just doesn't work. However, in the context of the website, that didn't matter because we were only ever accessing those APIs once the user already had an authenticated WIF session. So the user goes to the web page, it authenticates you, you have a WIF session, there's cookies that say you have a WIF session, and because our REST services were actually hosted in the same domain, in fact, on the same machines as the websites, then the cookies were valid And as far as the ASP.NET Web API was concerned, it knew who the user was. So in this particular context, we didn't have to do any extra work because we made that decision to put the APIs in the same spot as the website. Later on, when I start talking about the other parts of the application, this property didn't hold, so we had to come up with some different solutions. But that, for the website, at least it was pretty straightforward. So if I switch back to this guy, so what I've got here, it is the whole solution, but so I don't spend the whole time waiting for the source code. I've just built some shortcuts to the files that are interesting for each demo. So in order to set up WS Federation against Azure Active Directory, there's actually no code, but there's a whole lot of nasty configuration. So WIF has this thing called System Identity Model, and then there's a whole bunch of stuff, which I'm not expecting you to read, but a whole bunch of things that need to be there in order for everything to work. So it looks kind of scary. However, if you go and say create a new project, a new web project, and click change authentication, and then you say I want to use organizational accounts, and for either cloud, if it's AAD, you just put your Azure Active Directory tenant name, so I could do ocelot.onmicrosoft.com, or if it was on-premises, using ADFS, I could choose on-premises, and I could enter my my Federation metadata, which is something you can get from your people who maintain ADFS, and it will create all that nasty WIF configuration for you. So that's basically the way that you do this in the real world. I don't know what most of those settings are. It just put them there. If they work, I trust it. And that's kind of how you can go about creating that Federation session. So it turns out that at Microsoft, while we do have Azure Active Directory, we can't use it for passive WS Federation. So within the Microsoft environment, you can see I'm using configuration deltas. So web.azure.config is the one we use for Microsoft. Web.azure.aad is what we use for customers. So in this case, for Microsoft, we also have a system identity model thing. It's got some slightly different stuff in it. It's got some certificate thumbprints coded in and a few different things. That was also largely created by the tool when I just pointed it at our Federation metadata document. So depending on exactly what you're federating with, the configuration will differ, but the frameworks of using WIF and the tools in Visual Studio are the same regardless of what you're federating against. All good? Yeah, question. Yeah, so if it's multi-tenant, there was actually an option in that dial to say multiple directories. So it changes things like, there's no longer necessarily just one identity provider that you direct to. You actually have to sort of do more code to actually figure out who's who. So the platform does support the concept of multi-tenant applications, but inherently it does become a little bit more complex because you have to figure out who's who and make sure you load the right data once you come back from the from the identity provider, for example. But there you go, you asked a question, so I'll make sure they go away. Okay, so that was the website. Tray application, in some ways similar, but in some ways different. So the tray application needs to know who you are as well, because it's basically saying, hey, Tom can see all these Wi-Fi points, send that information to the server so it knows that that's where Tom is. So you can't do that if you can't identify users. While we can tolerate a few credential prompts for a website that you made a decision to visit, we would not tolerate credential prompts for the Tray app. The idea of the Tray app is you install it once and you forget it's there. Everyone hates being bothered by applications that are running in their system tray, so we really didn't want to be prompted ever again. And again, we wanted the same solution for everybody. On-premises, again, Windows integrated authentication, everything's really easy. So there's actually sort of two parts of this story for the Tray application. So what we originally did is actually not what we ended up with or what you should do yourself. But I'm sort of telling the story because it sort of shows how these technologies are evolving and how sometimes when there are gaps, you can kind of come up with your own solution and then move away from them. So I mentioned before that when you're talking to a REST API, you can't use passive WS Federation directly. We did on the website because we already had a session, but we don't have a session here. So there are a bunch of protocols like OAuth and JavaScript Web Tokens, which are the correct way of authenticating a REST API. At the time we started moving to Azure, there was no practical way for us to do that with the tools that are available. And what that means is I'm not smart enough or have the time or inclination to go and read specifications for exactly how OAuth works and do all that work by hand. So we did sort of a roll-your-own solution where the Tray app, basically the first time you open the Tray app, it launched a web page and a little window, which was protected by WS Federation, where you entered your credentials the first time. It issued a per-user token, which was basically my username signed with a keyed hash algorithm, and then I stored that token forever in the Tray app's configuration. And then every time the Tray app calls the web service, it stuck that token inside an authorization header. And then on the server side, it used something called a delegating handler, which could go and take that HTTP header, figure out who I am, and if it's a valid token, then go and generate a token. Generate a clients principle. So I said it's essentially the same concept as what OAuth does anyway, but it was a roll-your-own approach, and rolling your own security is never a very good idea, and we knew that there were a few weaknesses, such as if I left the company but kept my token, that token would still keep working and things like that. Like, location data is probably not the most critical thing in the world, but it was an issue. But I will show you, because it was actually still kind of neat little code that we used to make that work. So I won't show you the client side stuff, but if you do want to do any kind of pre-processing of authorization headers on the Find Me service, So I added this one line of code here, globalconfiguration.messagehandlers.addNewApplicationAuthentication_handler. So that's a programmatic way of actually injecting this a handler into the ASP.NET pipeline that lets you do things like interrogate HTTP headers before your code is actually called. What the handler does, so I won't go through all the code, but basically you override this particular method. It's looking for an authorization header and finding one that starts with find me user token. If it finds such a thing, it's checking against a regex to see whether the thing is vaguely well formed and pulling out the interesting bits. If it works, then I do some crypto inside this thing to check if the token is valid and whether the token actually matches the user. If it is valid, then I'm going to go and create a new claim, claims principle with that identity. Otherwise, I will complain somewhere and say the user's not authorized. So nice little self-contained code, didn't actually have any impact on the rest of the application. In fact, it's still sitting in there to deal with some legacy clients. So you can actually have multiple forms of authentication coexist within an ASP.NET solution quite happily. In fact, we've got three. We've got really the WIF stuff. We have this one, and we have the one I'm about to show you as well. Okay, so I mentioned that was our interim solution. Where we ended up was after a bunch of cool new things were released by the Microsoft engineering teams. And there was two cool things. One is an OWN module that enables Azure Active Directory bearer authentication for web APIs. OWN is a newish extensibility mechanism for IIS and ASP.NET that really does similar things to what I just showed you, but basically there's an API, I think it's all sort of open source, the API, and there's a bunch of different plugins that can basically be injected at different spots in the pipeline that can make all sorts of really hard problems really easy. And in order to have the full OAuth JWT standards-based authentication was about three lines of code that I had to add to the web service in order to have those tokens validated. On the client side, another cool new technology is something called ADAL, which is Active Directory Authentication Library. That is a client library that automates the process of having users sign into Azure Active Directory and generating authorization tokens that can be attached to web service requests. So it turned out that it was actually significantly less code to do the proper standards-based secure solution than the roll-your-own solution, particularly on the client side. So I'll show you what that looks like now. So let me start with the server side, because this is the really impressive thing about how simple this is. So Owen has this well-known entry point, which is a class called Startup and a method called Configuration. So you can have lots of Owen plugins if you want. It matters what order you put them in. In this case, I've just got one, which is authentication. And basically, this class I didn't write. This comes with the Owen plugin. So app.use Windows Azure Active Directory Bearer Authentication. If I didn't have autocomplete, I probably would have slipped my wrist, but I do. So I type in three characters and press Control Space. And then I just pass it two things, which are basically stuff that you can get out of your Azure Active Directory configuration. And that is literally it. So once I do that, the application will basically do the same thing that I did with my delegating handler. An authorization header will come in that will be a bearer authorization token, which looks like a bunch of stuff. This will know how to validate it and check it came from the right identity provider, and it will create a claims principle based on that, which the application can then use for authorization decisions. So, like, ridiculously easy to provide sort of strong authentication for your REST APIs. On the client side, it was almost as easy. It was a few extra things we needed to do, and part of it was complicated by the fact that we wanted to make sure the application could actually work on premises and potentially with different authentication schemes. So we added a few layers of abstraction, which architects love to do, to kind of make sure that we weren't tightly coupled to ADAL. So this is the interface we built, which is, think about, you're building a client application that needs to be authenticated. What are all the things it needs to do? So you need to know if you signed in, you need to know who you are, you need to be able to tell it to sign in and sign out, and you need to be able to get the current username and the current authorization token is really all that interface provides. So we have an on-prem version that basically does almost nothing because, again, with integrated authentication, it's kind of not much you need to do. But the ADAL token provider is an implementation of this class that uses the Active Directory Authentication Library, which you can get from NuGet, that basically handles all this stuff. So there's not really much stuff here, but basically this Authentication Context class is the main entry point to ADAL. And when I want to authenticate and get a token, I call this Acquire Token. So the user experience for this is that when the application doesn't know who you are, it shows a web browser and makes you enter your username and password. And once it does know who you are, it shouldn't be asking you again. The way you use ADAL is you don't do your own token caching under any circumstances. Every time you need a token, you ask it to acquire a token. ADAL is smart enough to not only cache tokens when you're already authenticated, but to handle what's something called refresh tokens. So if I have a token, the token has got a validity of some length of time, I don't even know what it is. After that token expires, there is a protocol that basically says, look, I've got an old token. I don't prompt the user, but give me a new token. So basically the ADAL will send the old token back to Azure Active Directory and says, yeah, Tom still works here. That token was valid, so here's a new token. So it will handle all of that stuff for you. It will actually only prompt who are you if basically has no idea who you are. The caveat around that is that ADAL has its own token cache, but when you use it by default, the token cache is in memory, and that means as soon as the process ends, the token cache is cleared. So the first time I did this, the user got prompted every time the application started, which was pretty lousy. The good news is there in this authentication context, you can actually specify a cache as a parameter. The cache can be whatever you want, and it's actually just a dictionary of some kind. A dictionary of token cache keys. But today at least, or last I checked, there are no implementations out of the box. So building your own requires either actually writing your own or searching the interwebs. So I found somebody, which I think was a Microsoft person, but they implemented an implementation of an ADAL cache that uses the Windows Credential Manager. So that's the same place that all your like IE passwords get stored, for example. So it's just the right spot to do things like that. So this person's cleverer than me because they can do p-invoke and all sorts of scary things. But it seems to work quite nicely. And if you set all the right flags, it's actually persistent, not just across process restarts, but across machine restarts. So this really achieved the goal of being prompted just once or when you explicitly sign out, if you want to switch users for any reason, and then you get never prompted again because ADAL is able to use that cache and that, that refresh logic. So all we have to do then, so this here is sort of the base class for our REST proxies. And basically when you initialize it, you get an implementation of our token provider, and it asks it for an authorization token, and then it just sticks it in the authorization header. So that's really all we have to do in order to actually call the services. So ADAR doesn't actually do anything about calling services, it just creates tokens for you. And those tokens can be added to your outgoing HTTP request really, really easily, and then that hooks into the first stuff that I showed you. That make sense? Sweet. Okay, the kiosk was really much the same. In fact, we went through the same journey in that we originally did that kind of roll your own solution. We had sort of similar requirements. And in the end, we moved to basically the same solution that I just showed you. The only sort of caveat here is there is an ADAL for Windows Store apps and there's an ADAL for .NET apps. They are almost the same, but they are not completely the same. There's a few subtle differences, and they are, in fact, different libraries. So if you've used one and you do the other one, it will be familiar but not identical. So I'll just quickly show you just a couple of things that were noteworthy about the kiosk. We actually use that same infrastructure in terms of the IA token provider. So you can see I've got a different implementation called Windows Store Token Provider. The other thing is the two versions are released both in NuGet, and they tend to come out at different times. So it's still evolving quite quickly, and usually the .NET one comes out a bit before the Windows Store one, and they sort of stagger the releases. So the only couple of things to note, firstly, we didn't need to do the same trick with the token cache. Although there is the ability of providing your own cache with a Windows Store one, by default it will cache them effectively forever as far as I can tell, so we didn't need to provide our own token cache. The other thing, and some of this is just a bit weird how Windows Store apps integrate with domains and stuff like that, but there's this thing called context.useCorporateNetwork, which you actually have to set to tell it whether the user is on the domain or not. And that seemed like a strange thing, as we don't know whether the user's on the domain or not. We're not telling them where they're using this application. So what's pretty ugly, but sometimes you have to do this as a developer, we figured out that if you say that you are on the domain and you're really not, it will fail really quickly. But if you do it the other way around, it will fail really slowly. So we are assuming that you are on the domain. And if it fails, then we'll assume that you're not on the domain. I don't know if this is going to change in newer versions. Like it's hugely ugly, but it solved the problem, so we moved forward. I don't even know why you have to tell it that, but anyway, that's what we had to do. Other than that, yeah, it looks slightly different code, but conceptually exactly the same. Windows Store apps also come up with a sort of nice built-in experience to show the identity provider and make you enter username and password, so you don't need to actually do any UI work. What you do need to do, though, is make sure you don't do this too early, because it might show UI if you tell it to go and get a token before your main window is drawn. It will hang because it has nowhere to show a UI, so you need to make sure that you delay this until you need it, is the other trick that we learned here. Okay, so now we know who the user is, we get to decide what they're allowed to do. And authorization is something which, again, sort of pretty well every internal application will almost certainly have some kind of requirements around it. So FIME's authorization requirements are actually simpler than probably the average internal application, but the techniques and things we did are still pretty relevant. So requirements, we've actually got three. Firstly, make sure that you can't use the application if you're not an employee of whatever organization you're supposed to be in. And again, because cloud applications are on the internet, you actually kind of have to think about that. If you're on the internal network, then you assume that people can only access the network if they work here. So yeah, but that was the first requirement. Second one is making sure that basically the tray application can't masquerade you and pretend you're somebody else. So even if you are allowed to use FIME, your employee can't go and pretend to be Sachin Nadella in terms of a location, it will figure that out. And the third requirement is only sort of a minor part of FIME, but it's probably a more traditional authorization requirement. So we have some admin pages. If we want to go and load up a new building or tell it where the access points are, we only want a few people who are FIME admins to be able to do that. So that's a typical role-based security requirement. So on-prem, for each of those three requirements, basically, again, Windows authentication basically provides your authorization capabilities as well. For the second one, it was really a very simple code check to say, does the current user's principal match the user ID that's attached to the payload? If not, then throw it away or return an error message. And for the third point, we used ASP.NET's authorization capabilities to basically do a role check on some of our controllers, so on our MVC controllers, to say, this part of the site can only be used by administrators. The one thing we did was we added a layer of indirection. So by default, the authorize attribute, you actually have to specify like a domain, backslash AD group name. Because we are deploying to different environments, we added a layer of indirection, so that actually goes in configuration, but it's all basically the same thing. So the Azure solution did exactly the same thing as the on-premises solution did. So all of that stuff really just relies on a principle knowing who the user is. So we didn't have to do really anything special or different because all those authentication approaches created principles. The only challenge was around the role membership. So when you authenticate with Windows, you have a Windows principle and you can ask, is this user a member of administrators? And it will say yes or no. Claims principles can do the same thing. So it knows about your group membership, or it could know about your group membership. And when you authenticate with ADFS, you can configure ADFS so that your groups come along as part of your SAML token that ultimately ends up being in the claim. So you have to go into ADFS and possibly talk to ADFS-y people to make that work. Within Microsoft, we basically said, look, we want to know whether each user is a member of the Find Me Administrators group, and please create a claim that tells us that. So ADFS does that quite happily. Azure Active Directory today does not do that. It is on the roadmap, but even though Azure Active Directory has this concept of groups, you can put people in groups quite happily, that information doesn't come through onto the claims principle. So you can say, is this user a member of administrators? It will always say no, because it doesn't know what groups you're in. However, there are, again, more extensibility points that let you go and do this. And we basically created something called a claims authentication manager that, again, hooks into a particular point in the pipeline that allowed us to query AAD for users' group memberships and then basically embellish the existing claims principle with that information. So I'll show you the code for that. This won't be a problem at some point in the nearest future. It will just work like ADFS, but I don't know when that will be. So, if you look at authorization, so firstly, I'll just show you our MVC controller for the management page. So don't worry about the compiler directive. But basically, we created a configurable authorize, which is just like a regular authorize. But rather than having the name of the AD group directly in the attribute, we put that in configuration file. So this is basically saying that, look, ASP.NET, don't let people access this unless they're in this group called administrators. And then inside configuration, I can somewhere, here we are. I can say that when on-prem, administrators means South Pacific / find me admin is all we did there. The other thing we can do, this is just normal .NET stuff, is deny anonymous users. And that just works regardless of whether the user is authenticated of ADFS or AAD or anything else. Inside AAD, the AAD configuration, I had to add this extra thing called a Claims Authentication Manager. And the Claims Authentication Manager, basically hooks in and I've lost my spot, uses something called Graph API. So Graph API is a REST API that is able to query Azure Active Directory, and there's a .NET library on top of that to find out all about stuff in the directory, including what group someone's in. So can point to good resources on it. Look, there's MSDN is the short answer. I'll show you a couple other things about that in a minute. But it's quite simply, we're getting connection, we're figuring out what groups they are, and we're adding them to the claim, is really what we're doing there. Bit of random code here, but it's not too much. Basically, we're doing a few filters and things to pull that information out of Azure Active Directory. And then it all worked nicely. So I'm running a bit short of time, so yeah, quick. That is a good question. I don't think I'm explicitly caching it. Whether Rick caches it, I'm not sure. I probably should know, but yeah, I don't. That's an excellent question. You get a speaker for that. Um, Okay, so directory queries. So you saw all the requirements before in terms of basically all those nice things like autocomplete, getting photos, getting full names. LDAP is very powerful and very easy to hang yourself with and very easy to write appallingly performing things. Graph API is sort of the reverse. It's less powerful. There's some things that you want it to do that it won't do, but it also you won't run into performance problems or memory problems sort of quite as easily. So I just showed you some code using the .NET client for Graph API. At the time, so I did that quite recently. At the time that I did this other stuff, that didn't exist. So I'm actually interacting directly with the raw REST API. It's the same thing. It's just a different way of doing it. What there is a cool tool, and in question about resources, there's a tool called graphexplorer.cloudapp.net, which just kind of lets you see what's in there. So it's all based on resources, so I'm already authenticated here. So if I ask inside the Microsoft directory, who's this tomhole@microsoft.com person, unless it's timed out, which it possibly has, but basically there's this users, unauthorized, yeah, sorry. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the big JSON document. That's basically what Graph API does. I won't show you now, but it's a whole bunch of JSON stuff where you can see all the things that might be in the directory: my name, my phone number, my manager, my direct reports, if I had any, my photo, all that kind of stuff is all basically in these documents. So what we had to do for directory queries, again, we built an interface, because we wanted the same thing to continue to work with LDAP for our on-prem installation. So you can see these are the directory things that we need to be able to do. And then we have a Graph API version. And so this is the ugly version of the code, because I'm basically doing a whole bunch of, let me just find, you can see here that I'm creating URLs explicitly. I'm using JSON.NET, a great Kiwi product, to go and iterate through and pull bits out of the attributes. So it's not hard code, it's just slightly ugly code. If you do it today, you use the Graph API and it's all .NET properties, so it's much, much neater. But a really nice way of being able to build these applications that are intrinsically kind of aware of their environment and who else is in the organization. Yep. Not at the moment. Could you use WMI? You can't use WMI to query AAD, no. You can query AAD, but not AAD. And from the cloud, you can't talk to AAD. So again, they're completely different beasts. The only way they interact is through DirSync, basically. So that was kind of it from the identity side, just to kind of quickly wrap it up. A few other things we did that were not identity related, but just might be things to consider if you're moving applications to Azure. So the configuration, we moved a bunch of things that are likely to change between deployments from web.config to service configuration. If you're using cloud services, that's a great place to put things because you can change them without redeploying your app. If you're using Azure websites, it's not so much a problem because you can actually modify web.config through the portal directly. But the goal is that all of our AAD customers have a single web.config transform, and anything that's kind of tenant-specific goes in a service configuration file. From a storage perspective, we moved a few things that were in the file system to blob storage. So in the case of FireMe, our maps are all SVG files, and we have quite a lot of them. We want to be able to bring in a new building without deploying the application. So while we originally had them in the file system, and that meant we basically couldn't, we had to deploy the app with each new building we brought on. So putting big things like maps into blob storage firstly made the deployment smaller and quicker, and also meant we could actually upload maps without actually disrupting the application deployment. Instrumentation, the approach to instrumentation always needs to be thought of when you're moving to the cloud, particularly if you have multiple machines. So Azure Diagnostics is a way of gathering log files and pushing that to Azure blob storage and table storage. So pretty basic to configure, but a few things need to look at. And we also found out that resiliency is always something you have to think about with the cloud. When you put things on the internet and there's networks and backhoes and all sorts of things between you and the cloud, things can sometimes be not quite so reliable. So putting in retry logic under certain operations is generally a good practice when building applications for the cloud. So just to wrap it up, I have a couple of minutes questions. So I showed you this picture before of the overall application architecture, and I showed you kind of what we did on premises. Just to show you what we ended up with, So there still is an Active Directory for any kind of real organization. You still need to have this thing running. But FireMe does not talk to it directly. So that was kind of the whole point about this, is to decouple the application from Active Directory. So instead, we replaced it with all this stuff, which looks a little bit complicated. But Active Directory is dir-synced to AAD. And for Microsoft, we also have ADFS in the picture, but you don't necessarily need that. The user authenticates through this complex protocol called passive authentication. But again, it's handled for you pretty directly. And the FireMe service actually uses three different ways to authenticate users. It uses the WIF sessions, it uses the AAD bearer authentication, and because we haven't ripped it out yet, it also uses our custom authentications. And all of those end up with principles being created. For the Tray app and the kiosk, we use ADAL for authentication, and we cache the token inside ADAL effectively using those caches, so the user doesn't get prompted, and it handles all that for us. And in order for the application to get that information outside of the directory, we're using the Azure Active Directory Graph API for all of those queries. And for Exchange Web Services, yeah, nothing really different except for the fact that we're explicitly defining those credentials. And links also the same. So yeah, so just to recap, so if you have an on-premises application, yeah, most of it will almost certainly just move with absolutely no changes. And even around identity, you see, I didn't actually change much code at all. There's a few places where I built some very self-contained things that plugged into the ASP.NET pipeline, but I didn't actually make any changes whatsoever to my application code. So don't get too scared by this, and if your application doesn't have quite so many moving parts, you probably won't be faced with all of these. But really, the moral of the story is you can build a secure internal application, deploy it to Azure, and actually end up with a better experience for your users if you think the right authentication strategies and that people can access these applications from wherever they are. So a few other sessions, some of which I think are already passed, but a few other things that are vaguely related. Someone's asking about, Graph API, I don't know if that's in that topic, but there's stuff on Azure Active Directory later today. A few other sort of Azure topics that I thought might be worth checking out. Feel free to drop me a mail, tom.hollander@microsoft.com, or I've got some blog posts, some of which cover some things vaguely related to what we spoke about today. I'm not a huge Twitter user, but if you tweet me, I probably will notice and respond eventually. Yeah, there's a question there? Is Xero good enough for you? So Azure Active Directory is free. There is Azure Active Directory Premium, which gives you a bunch of extra cool stuff. But the Azure Active Directory is actually literally free. So yeah, pretty decent price. Yeah. Yep. The thing I was mainly talking about was the website's integration with Link. So that was where you can see these halos. So yeah, there is there's a plugin called a name control, NameCtrl, that basically you talk to via JavaScript, but it uses a browser plugin that works on multiple browsers that talks to the running Link client. So if I were to sign out of my Link client, then all these halos would disappear. So the Tray app also happens to talk to Link just to update my location. That's using the Link API, which is a different approach there. Yep. The back. No, look, this is, as a developer slash architect, things change all the time. So I'm from Australia. I know a few random people, but I'm not going to sort of comment on the partner landscape in New Zealand and risk offending or awarding half people in the room probably. But look, it is the job of someone who is building applications today to know the platform, know the capabilities. If someone says, hey, I need an internet application on the cloud, how do I do it? The answers are all what I just told you. So if you're dealing with people that don't know those answers, they're probably not the right people, I would say. But yeah, it's basically bread and butter for cloud architecture today. Yep.
You talked about the problem of Joe user could have gone to coffee, but the identity still showing it.
Yes, we did. And yes, obvious probably question, but you can get a speaker for that. Yeah, there's actually some challenges around which APIs exist on the phone. So we are looking at building a phone client, but we can't actually use, you can't use either iOS or Windows phone to be able to locate people based on Wi-Fi. You can do it based on Bluetooth beacons, but we haven't got, the nice thing about the solution is there's no actual impact on the building itself. It's just what's already there. So, yeah, there are solutions that do that as well. They're also more disruptive. Like some retail stores do that where the routers know which MAC addresses are around. So yeah, not a bad solution, but much more disruptive in that you actually need to know, you need to know what kind of networks and get in. So they're all valid solutions. For the constraints we were in, we're pretty happy with what we came up with, but there are some limitations around mobile devices in particular. Okay, I've got one more thing to give away. So actually, the guy... This guy who we've always said that got the speaker still around? yeah, don't forget evals as well. Sam. Oh, you did too.